Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our webinar today, Handling a Payments or Data Incident. Just a reminder, you've all joined the webinar on mute only. So any questions you have, please feel free to ask them in the chat area at the side. So look, welcome Simon Whittaker and Greg James, who are our hosts for this afternoon's session. And Simon is an expert in all things related to cybersecurity. And Simon will start us off. And then we'll move on to Greg James, who is our leading expert on all things relating to GDPR and payments and dealing with the regulator on an ongoing basis. So without further ado, I will hand you across to Simon. Good afternoon, Simon.
Hello there, Elaine. Thank you very much. And thanks for the introduction there. So yes, as Elaine says, we're going to be speaking to you today about some of the bits and pieces around handling a payments or data incident, I'm going to be focusing on some of the practical steps that we feel are really useful to be taking into account, and then we're going to be following up with Greg talking about some of the ideas from his side, which is very much more around the regulatory side. And also talking about those four letters, the magic four letters of GDPR, which I'm going to mention and then run away from. So I'm going to talk to you about essentially five different things. Firstly, the strange times we're living in, and what we keep hearing. We keep hearing about this, the new normal, or the way things are, or whatever. But we are in a different world at the moment, and I think that's really interesting to reflect on. Then talking through about some of the data breaches that have happened in the past and how they've taken place. Some of the steps you can do before an incident occurs. So what are the steps that you can take before an incident occurs to help you with the next step, which are practical steps to take when something does go wrong. And finally, just a very quick mention about personal data breaches, because I think it's really, really important to be aware of these things, especially considering the recent judgments being handed down by the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK for British Airways. I think it's very important to reflect on those. So just a little bit about me. I've been working in the IT industry for many, many years. Been working in what used to be called security and is now termed cybersecurity since about 2006, 2007, something like that. I work with a lot of different firms to help them to understand their security posture, whether that's through security and penetration testing or through helping them to understand the impact that their infrastructure and their security, software has on their security, and also assisting with things like IT audits, making sure that they've got various items in place, and also making sure that we can help improve processes and procedures. So as I mentioned before, we're living in strange times. These are very, very strange. It's a very strange world we're in still. Lots of the country now going back into lockdown. I'm based in Northern Ireland, and so we now have various different rules in place around when people are allowed to go to the office and when they're not allowed to go to the office. And that is leading to a lot of interesting issues coming to the fore. I think that it's important that we reflect back on some of the items that that can occur here. What we should list here is that disruptive events can have a high impact on consumers and businesses. Firms need to know where the risks to their service delivery lie and make sure they're prepared for any service disruption by testing their planned response. That includes breaches. That includes what you will do in the event of something going badly wrong. Okay, this all still matters, no matter whether there's a pandemic on or not. All of this still matters, and I think it's really important to reflect on that. So let's look back at what's happened in some of the previous data breaches, and what was done well and what was done poorly, in some of those worlds. So firstly, if we go back to the dark ages of 2013, if anyone remembers that far back, yes, there were computers back then for those young pups, but and yes, people were breaking into them. Back in 2013, we can see 40 million customer records stolen from Target. Neiman Marcus had millions impacted. Home Depot in the US had 56 million credit card details stolen from their systems. JP Morgan Chase data breach during 2014 impacted 76 million households and 7 million small businesses. The Sony Pictures compromise in November 14 led to massive amounts of confidential internal information being breached. In fact, if you still go to WikiLeaks and search for Sony, you will find that every single one of their internal emails was provided is still searchable within the archive. So there's a huge amount of information. Just out of interest, one of the things that I found most interesting about the Sony Pictures breach was that there were a couple of files being sent around by email called things like passwords.xlsx or passwords.txt. And that included all the social media passwords for all of the Sony Pictures Entertainment properties. So if you wanted to be Spider-Man for the day, you absolutely had the opportunity to be so. The Office of Personnel Management, including 5.6 million fingerprints, were all made available in data breaches. Ashley Madison, a very insalubrious, non-salubrious organization, but they had all of their data breached back in July 15. TalkTalk, which had a bit of a Northern Irish angle from where I'm sitting, a young man from Ballymena was involved with that. A 16-year-old boy was part of that. And I think it's important to reflect on TalkTalk because, in my view, it's an understanding of how data breaches shouldn't be handled in many respects. One of the things that we can commend them for is that they were honest and open about it, and they spoke about it, and they talked about it in the press and in the public. But one of the biggest issues that they had is that they did not know what data had been pinched. They didn't know what data had been stolen from them. So how on earth were they supposed to work everything out and let us know what was going on? So TalkTalk, I think, is a particularly interesting example when it comes to breaches. Then we moved on to LinkedIn, Dropbox, Yahoo, Equifax, and then we get into 2018 and onwards. And I have a particular interest, obviously, when 2018 onwards, from May 2018, is when the Data Protection Act in the UK was enacted. And therefore, we start to see some of these some of these organizations being fined and them starting to have to kind of explain themselves to the regulator, the ICO regulator, the data protection regulator. Of particular interest there is obviously our British Airways one. There was a announcement very recently just specifying that they were going to be compelled to pay £20 million. Which has gone down from, I believe, 158 million before. But £20 million is still an awful lot of money for an organization, especially in the current situation. So data breaches are big, they're happening, people handle them poorly, and we've got to do something about them. Just to reflect on sizes again. So if we look at sizes of this, we go back to 2015 again there, we go down to things like Deep Roots Technologies, looking up to Equifax in 2017, moving on to Oxidata and Marriott and various bits and pieces like that. We can see British Airways just making a little appearance down here, £20 million worth of an appearance, but there we go. And also this Marriott one that we can see here, which reflects they will be the next big fine, I think, that we will start to we'll hear more about. And then we go to Yahoo and their 3 billion users, according to various sources. It goes from between 1 and 3 billion. And then we reflect back and we look at the fact that we've got these different images about what attackers and what people who are breaching our information look like. It wouldn't be a presentation about cybersecurity if somebody wasn't wearing a balaclava. So here we go. Here's our person in a balaclava working in the cold environment, hacking and cracking into our banks. And then we've got this chap here who is obviously can't make the Zoom function on his laptop work effectively. So therefore, we are seeing the we're seeing the you know, we're seeing them having to. Sorry, I'm just having some sound issues on my computer here. So we're seeing them having to we're seeing them having to use their Zoom function on their laptop. And finally, in honor of our in honor of our young man in Ballymena, we can see that we have this young man here who is hacking and cracking into our various bank accounts as well. In actual fact, the reality is very much more like this. It's people sitting in offices. They're having stand-ups. They're communicating. They're talking about all of the the issues they're facing. I'm trying to get into card provider X and I can't. They have firewall Y in place. What can we do? And I think that this reflects, interestingly, to our to the UK head of cybersecurity for KPMG back in the day, who specified that it was time to think differently about cyber risk, ditching the talk of hackers and recognizing that our businesses are being targeted by ruthless criminal entrepreneurs with business plans and extensive resources. They're intent on fraud, extortion, or theft of hard-won intellectual property. So it's ruthless criminal entrepreneurs is what we need to say now. Doesn't flow off the tongue quite as well as hackers does, but you know that'll do us. So what can we do when this when these sort of things happen? Well, before an incident happens, we've got to prepare. So preparation is absolutely the key. Okay, so we've got to make sure that we are planning what's going to happen. We've got to make sure that we understand what each one of us would do in that situation. We've got to prepare so that we've got ways in which we can communicate with one another. We've got Zoom functionality and calls available. And then we've also got to practice. So we've got to know what we would do in case of a problem. And that's an absolutely vital thing to be doing. So I draw here from a couple of different government sources, and I think this is a very useful thing to be preparing. You know, there is some really useful guidance here from the National Cybersecurity Center. You know, the first one being that the most important thing is to know who your contacts are. So who are your key contacts here? Who are your who are the people that you should be speaking to? You know, it's really important that we've got those people in place. We should have a list of them. We should have a list of people that we are trying to that we need to need to be communicating with. We need to have escalation criteria. So we need to understand what we would do if we needed to escalate. So how do we manage to escalate our calls? Do we know who the right people are to speak to, firstly, and then do we know how to kind of escalate those requests, how to escalate those requirements? Then we've got to have a basic flow chart. So what is your playbook? That's what they're sometimes called. So thinking about your playbook. You know, how would you, what steps can you follow? Can they be followed at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning, which is when all of this stuff usually happens? You know, do we have a flowchart in place to enable us to do that? Do we have all of those kind of things planned out? Do we have a conference number? Or are we all just going to phone through from various, you know, various mobiles into one location? Or what do we do? What's the best thing for? What's the best way for us to work together? And also, you've got to make sure you've got basic guidance on legal or regulatory requirements. So, so having somebody in the room who understands what requirements are from a legal and regulatory perspective, that's the most important thing. I took this from a NIST publication, and I think this is really useful as well, because I think it shows, you know, who you need to be communicating with during an incident. Who are your incident response team supposed to be communicating with? Well, there's lots of different areas. We start with internet service providers. We've had an incident where somebody's compromised all of our infrastructure. Can we block off our internet access, or make it only from certain locations, or access from various places? Can we do that? We have to have a good relationship with our internet service providers to do that. So we've got them. And then we've got our software and support vendors. So we want to make sure that they are they're able to help us should an issue occur. So do we know who to speak to there? We should have details about who to communicate with. What about our customers? Well, yes, we need to be able to communicate with them. And how do we communicate with them? I used the example earlier of the Twitter feeds being compromised from the Sony Pictures Entertainment issue. Are you confident that you could continue to communicate with your customers in the middle of a data incident through your Twitter handle or a Twitter feed? Is that appropriately secured? Other incident response teams, are there other teams within either your organization or further afield who you would need to speak to? And finally, I think for this one is law enforcement agencies. If something has happened, if someone has broken into your information systems, or you've had some information that has been stolen, shall we say, then speak to law enforcement. You're very, very, very absolutely right to do so in many cases. They will assist you in many cases with what you need to do next. And I think they're really important people to bring in. And again, what do I think of this? Well, this has come from your NIST publications, where we talk here about preparation, detection and analysis, containment, eradication and recovery, and then post-incident activity. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit, just in our practical steps. But that's what's important to remember is that as an organization, the biggest things you can do to help yourself from an incident or data security incident or a payments incident is to prepare. And these are just some steps I thought would be useful to highlight as well. So first things first, what do we want to do? Well, don't assign blame. There's plenty of time for doing that later down the road. But we don't want to assign blame initially or cause any hassle. What we're trying to do is get to the root of the problem. We want to make sure we can support a culture of teaching and learning for all of your teams. Making sure that they've got access to know how they can secure your systems. We want to make sure that we're trusting, enabling, and verifying. So we do trust, we do enable our users, but we also verify. And we want to give them a platform for being able to discuss problems openly. It's a really important step to be able to take. So now we come down to the real kind of guts of the matter, as it were, some practical steps. Okay, so some practical steps that you can take. And they come down to, we think, these kind of four areas, which is people, communication, containment, and action. And it kind of goes back to the areas that I was talking about previously from the NIST study. Okay, so people, who are the right people to get involved in this issue? We need to get those right people in place. We need to communicate effectively internally and externally. So understand how you will communicate with your teams and with your clients and with your suppliers and customers and regulators and all of that sort of thing. Establish that line of communication early. I've seen some fantastic examples of this where you just leave a conference call running and people dial in and out as they need to, but you have a central base where everybody can report back, and there's an incident manager whose job it is to run these things. And that's really important. Containment, making sure that you've got all the right things in the right place, and then getting the problem contained, and then making sure that you can take the next step, which is to take action. And action is the key thing, but you've got to contain the issue. The amount of times we see that people feel they have an issue under control, and then later they discover that actually the attacker has left the back door for themselves, or they've been able to leave themselves in. I also think this is very useful, and I think this is an important kind of document for helping you to understand what your processes should be. So this is a way of establishing what is a low, medium, high, or critical issue. Now, this is, it must be explained, this is obviously different from the FCA's guidance around this, but this is a very good thing for an internal issue. Okay, so these are very, very useful to get right, and also something that you can use within your own documentation. So within here, for instance, we can see that a critical issue affects 80% of staff who are unable to work. Critical systems offline with no known resolution, high risk to sensitive client or personal data, financial impact, and a severe reputational damage. Those are all things that make it a critical issue. Okay. So establish those, work those out for yourself, understand what a critical issue means. And then when you're kind of assessing these issues, you've got to make sure that you're following some some guidance. So make sure you've appointed an incident manager, somebody whose job it is to manage all of these things, making sure that they can then prioritize carefully all of their findings and make sure that they're constantly reviewed and correlated as they may lead to new tasks. The initial priority is to understand enough to take containment and mitigation actions, and then ultimately to remediate the attack. But don't just try to fix the problem immediately. Do your investigation, do your reconnaissance, have your understanding of what the problem actually is. Containment is important. So from the containment side of things, do you want to take some critical systems offline? You know, you have to take steps to reduce the impact of the incident. Is taking that system offline going to prevent the incident from getting worse, for instance? If it is, do it. Make it happen. Give the incident manager the power to be able to do that, so that she can take control and make sure that that systems are taken offline as required. There should be no running it up the flagpole to see who salutes, etc. It should just happen. Making sure that you have the power to block activity, isolate systems, and reset accounts. Making sure that that's a really important thing. But while you're doing this, you need to consider the consequences of any such actions, either good or bad. You've got to make sure that you're aware of those. And then you've got to evaluate the possibility that the attacker will react to the actions or bury themselves more deeply in the network. This is why the containment stage is so vital to us. We've got to make sure that we're understanding the full impact of the attack. And in the next couple of stages, it's about getting back to where we can business as usual. The remediation and eradication stage, the aim of this is to fully remove the threat from our networks and systems. Okay, so what we're doing is we're taking the containment stage that we've just seen, and we're going to remove the threat completely. But this is why the reconnaissance stage is so important. It's absolutely vital to confirm that remediation has been successful before moving to the recovery stage. Otherwise, you're back in a circle and you're going straight back to where you were at the beginning, where you have to start your reconnaissance all over again. And then you've got recovery. At this point, systems are returned to business as usual, or probably after extensive investigation or whatever, but put back to systems as usual. Clean systems and data are put back online, and in some cases, final actions are taken to handle regulatory, legal, or PR issues. But this is the recovery phase. This is where we're trying to get to, but we shouldn't try and get there too fast. And finally, just from a personal data breach point of view, if your data involves personal data, then there are some additional requirements. Drawn up this, I want to say simple and easy flowchart, but this is just something that I thought would be very useful. So obviously starts up at the top. What are your signs of a breach? And then going all the way through here to work out whether it's a data is classified as personal data. If it is, then there are probably there are things that you need to do. You need to notify the ICO potentially if there is there's a light risk to people's rights and freedoms. And then you've also got to work out whether you've got to notify the individuals concerned, whether there's been any issues. So this just a flowchart that I've decided to, that I've just pulled together here to help out from a GDPR perspective. And I think Greg's going to be talking more about that in a second. And speaking of Greg, I'm going to hand over to his capable hands now. I just need to change my screen around to get his slides up. Greg, are you there? Yes, you are. Hello.
Yeah, just checking you can hear me okay.
Perfect. Yes, absolutely brilliant. You should now be able to see the screen. And Greg, you just let me know when you need the slides changed, okay?
Yeah, that's grand. So yeah, hi everyone. I'm Greg James, and Ilian kind of gave me a bit of an introduction at the start there, so I won't bore you with it again. Really what I'm going to be looking at today is the reporting side of what Simon's been talking about. And that is really your reporting obligations as e-money or payment institutions under GDPR and under PSD2. So if we go to the next slide there, it's really just an introduction to what are these reportable incidents? What are we really talking about here? So we go on to the next one. So yeah, the legal frameworks. For e-money and payment institutions, we're really looking at two main pieces of regulation and guidance, and that is the EBA guidelines on major incident reporting, and what I'll refer to them as the guidelines as we go through this presentation, and the GDPR. And that's really the framework that we're going to be focusing on throughout this throughout chatting about breaches, data incidents, and anything really that you could refer to them under. So obviously they have very different objectives, both of the guidelines and the GDPR. They're both governed by separate pieces of legislation, and they have very different ideas of what they want. So it's important to kind of delve down deep into what does that actually entail. And if we go on to the next slide there. At a very high level, just breaking it down, the guidelines are in relation to your regulated business, that being your payment services / e-money offerings, and GDPR covers only personal data. Now, personal data can be so broad of a definition that obviously means it gets pulled into more conversations than you may necessarily think at the initial point. But that is, it is a good definer anyway. You can immediately remove reporting under the GDPR as long as any breach hasn't affected personal data. The guidelines, the PSD2 guidelines on major incident reporting really focus on your regulated service. In saying that, there are events that will affect your business as a whole and in turn will affect your regulated business. So it isn't a clean cut as GDPR reporting is with personal data, but it still is helpful to realize that what is really the concern of the regulator is the activities for which you are regulated for. And we can go on to the next slide there. And then on to the next one. What we're really going to be chatting through in the first instance is reporting under PSD2. So first off, major incident, what does that even mean? So a major incident is an operational and security event that has a major impact on your firm's stakeholders. Now, what is an operational security event? Operational security event, effectively a singular series of linked events unplanned by the payment service provider, which has or will probably have an adverse impact on the integrity, availability, confidentiality, authenticity, and or continuity of payment-related services. So it's a rather wide definition. You will likely suffer from operational security events somewhat regularly from very minor system outages of a matter of minutes to phishing attacks that are immediately closed down. You will come across these. Not all of them are considered major incidents that require reporting to the National Competent Authority. The National Competent Authority, just to for clarification, is your financial regulator in your member state. So that will be for the UK, FCA, for Ireland, it's the CBI, and so on and so forth. And if we go on to the next slide, we get quite a helpful flow chart. This is effectively a flow chart just from the EDI guidelines, and this makes it really, really clear on what is considered a major incident and what isn't. And that is anything, if you hit one of the higher impact criteria, it's immediately a major incident, you need to report that to the FCA, the CBI. If it doesn't hit any of the higher impact criteria, but it hits more than three of the lower impact criteria, then it's, three or more of the lower impact criteria, then it's considered a major incident as well. So it isn't just these big ticket items that will be considered major. Smaller items can add up into a major event, and that's important to clarify, and it's important to distinguish. If we go on to the next slide here, we'll show, okay, well, what is what's higher impact finding, higher impact and what is lower impact. Here is simply a set out of what is higher impact. I won't go through them in a tremendous detail there. They're somewhat straightforward, but I do want to focus in on what's really captured there, and that is transactions affected, clients affected, economic impact, and high level of internal escalation. They're important to realize because they are not all completely focused on your regulated business. For instance, economic impact, if it hits your legal entity for a significant amount of capital, then even if it isn't related to the regulated service, that capital is related to is directly connected to your regulated service, and therefore you will need to report it. So that's why I was caveating the split at the start on when you have to report in respect to major incidents. I do want to focus in a little bit more on the economic impact, because this wording is slightly bizarre and it has caused confusion for people in the past. So just to read it out, the economic impact, so it's a higher level impact if it has a direct or indirect cost related to the incident exceeded 0.1 tier one capital euros 200,000, or direct or indirect costs relating to an incident exceeding 5 million euros. Now, what does that mean? In effect, what that means is if you have an operational security event that at absolute minimum hits the business for 200,000, or at least there is an estimate that will hit the business for about 200,000 euros, then that requires reporting. And an upper limit of anything over 5 million also requires reporting. There is wiggle room in the middle. So if you as a firm have more than 200,000 euros of tier one capital, 0.1% of your tier one capital, which by the way is a huge amount and likely won't affect people on this call, but just as an academic point, if you have 0.1% tier one capital over 200,000K, then you go into this almost limbo area, and you report then on anything that is 0.1% of your tier one capital up to 5 million euros. So regardless of the size of your business, regardless of the amount of capital that you may maintain, if this event hits you for more than 5 million or more, then you must report it to the National Competent Authority. And if we go on to the next slide there, we can just notice that these are the lower impact findings. So in order for you to trigger a reporting obligation to your national company authority, you will have to hit three of these. And that can add up fairly quickly. So that lowers the amount, the kind of thresholds here. And if we look here, there's things here that aren't really topics and criteria mentioned here that aren't in the major incidents. That being service downtime, effects on other payment service providers or infrastructure, reputational impact. They're not really covered. They seem to be considered by the regulators as by nature lower impact, at least in regards to reporting to them. Just on to the next slide. So let's assume for the meantime that something has occurred. Either you've hit one of the major criteria, you've hit three of the minor criteria. What actually happens? What do you have to do? And that is effectively a report to your national competent authority. In the UK, that's the FCA and so on. So you must report within 4 hours of the discovery of the event, and that's important. You do not report on when you classify the event as major, and what that means in reality, and whenever one of these events occur within your firm, is that you may not be convinced it's a major incident at this point, but your estimates may push it into a major incident, and you may need to report to the FCA saying, This is a major incident, and then retract that. And that is a purposeful building within the guidelines. They want you to report it. And then if you must retract it, retract it. So it's very important that you make that 4 hour deadline. The initial report itself is fairly straightforward. It is simply high level what happened. Who are you? When did you discover it? Things like that. And if we go on to the next slide there. After you submit the initial report, you'll need to submit what's called an intermediate report. An intermediate report is effectively, they want a wee bit more detail around this now. So you're allowed 3 days, in effect, 3 days after you submit your initial report to submit an intermediate report. And what you're really saying in the intermediate report is, throughout these 3 days or 1 or 2 days, you can't exceed 3 days. So however many days it takes you to assess what's really happening here, you will start to work through that. And what you're really describing to the FCA or whatever your national competent authority is what happened, or how did it develop? What's the background? What areas were affected? Has your crisis management been been activated? What are the figures? What are the impact criteria? So has it been your transactions that have been affected? Has it been you've just had a high level of internal escalation for this issue? Has it had a reputational impact already? Things like that. And it really is just a more detailed breakdown of what exactly has happened in this scenario. A couple of things to note and a couple of things that can cause confusion. You must put in an intermediate report at no later than 3 days after you put in your initial report. You may continue to submit intermediate reports every 3 days until your service effectively goes back into its normal system. So as soon as normal business functions resume, then you submit your final report, your final intermediate report, which is effectively there to say, listen, this is all being sorted by. We've started our normal processes again, and we're just making you aware. And that is kind of the end of your intermediate and the end of your updates to the regulator. All that's left then is kind of a final report to the regulator, and that is effectively to show, okay, this is what happened. This is the issue. So if we go on to the next slide, that's the final report. And the final report, you really have at most 2 weeks to submit it from when you submit your final intermediate report, so when business resumes. And really there you're charting out everything that you will have done internally. So what's the root cause analysis? What happened? How are you going to make sure that doesn't happen again, et cetera, et cetera? And all that information is going to feed back into your risk assessment anyway, and back into your governance model. So that's really the reporting set out. So we go on to the next slide there, just a couple of tips whenever you're doing this. You have far less space to write about the event than you think you do. So the biggest report is going to be your intermediate reports, that where you're charting out exactly what's happened, what's the impact, and give a description. You actually have very little space to talk about what happened there. And the temptation is to type everything and to kind of give as grand a kind of description of everything as possible and say what you're doing about it, what everything around that. The reality is you don't actually have a lot of space to describe it. So be very sparing and understand that the FCA or whoever's accepting this wants just what happened and a kind of a high level description. Don't go into the nitty gritty. You just don't have the space for it. The reporting form simply won't let you do it. The most common issue we see with this is people not reporting within the 4 hours with the initial report. That is almost invariably because staff are not trained in their escalation processes. So make sure if you take something away from today that you ask staff if they understand the escalation processes, because they're absolutely essential for you to hit that 4 hour window, because it is not a long amount of time in the business world. And of course, any breach that happens, anything that happens within the firm, regardless of whether you send it on to the competent authority or the regulator, you record that within your breach register and you build that into your management system or around your risks. Because obviously, if something happens, that informs whether your mitigations are actually appropriate. So that's just kind of a few tips and considerations. We go on to the next slide. Just in the future, what there are going to be a few changes to these. So the EBA is currently consulting on changes to these guidelines, which are due to close on the 14th of December. Those changes are fairly minimal. They're not massive in nature. They're adding effectively a new classification criteria in the form of breach of security measures. And they're also clarifying a few of the calculation criteria. That isn't in effect yet, but keep an eye on that. And it may change how we do these reports in the future. And if we go on to the next slide, I'm slightly conscious of time, so I will try and get through this. Effectively, this is reporting under GDPR. And this is when you've identified that this incident has affected personal data. And it's this operational security incident has affected personal data of persons. So under this next, so what we have here is, what we need to make clear is, you may be reporting to the personal data regulator and your financial regulator in respect to operational security incidents. And that is simply because they are governing very different things. So in the UK, you'll be reporting to the FCA for a breach in your payment services requirements, and you'll be reporting to the ICO in relation to any GDPR breaches. In Ireland, you'll be doing that to the CBI and the DPC respectively. So just bear in mind that you could be reporting under two different regulations here. If we go on to the next slide. So very simply, a personal data breach. So when does this get through? So a personal data breach is a breach of security leading to the accidental, unlawful destruction, loss, altercation, unauthorized disclosure, or access to personal data. So it has to be personal data, but personal data is so broad that if it even comes into your mind, could this be considered personal data? Then chances are it's personal data. So it possibly doesn't limit as much as you would like, but regardless, that does limit this. And if we go on to the next slide, there are two stakeholders that we need to consider when reporting GDPR breaches, and that is the regulator, so the ICO in the UK and the DPC in Ireland, and the data subject. So unlike the PSD2 guidance and reporting on data and reporting on major incidents, you may have to inform the data subject that something has gone wrong here and that their data has been affected. And that is a very sensitive communication that needs to be drafted. So it's worth going into what that actually means. So if we go on to the next slide there. When do you have to report to the regulator? So when do I have to report to the ICO or the DPC? And that is when a breach is likely to result in a risk to a data subject's rights or freedoms. So not a high risk, not just any risk in any way. So that obviously is quite a wide definition. But I would encourage and make clear that there are certainly circumstances in which you would not you would not report to the ICO or the DPC. And that is something that the ICO have even called out. If I were complaining about over reporting back in 2018, and things have not really changed since then. So be sure that what you're reporting to the ICO actually requires reporting to the ICO. So one of the key changes here between this and the major incidents is you have a bit more of a flexible time frame. You have 72 hours to inform them of the breach. And because you have a bit more time, you have a bit more time to assess it. And during that assessment, you can make a decision on whether this is something that needs reported or something that can simply go into your breach register. So we go on to the next slide there. What are the possible examples of something that we need reported and something that we need reported? And they actually have a few examples on the website. So I would encourage you to have a read of those, but just to kind of put this into what will likely be relevant to yourselves. When do you not need to report to the regulator? If you sent client KYC information and sanctioned data to a member of the finance team. So the issue there is that finance team shouldn't really have contact or access to that data. So technically speaking, there's been a data breach. Now, that isn't reportable to the ICO simply because those members of staff are within a control function, and that control function is that control function is within the organization. There's also considerations for the fact that you can easily track that data. You know exactly where it's gone. You know it's been deleted off the system, off their emails now, and you can track that through and close off any of the risks there. Where it would change, and this is where we need to realize these are very case-by-case based. If you sent that KYC information or sanction data to an unrelated business, now we've entered into certainly a risk to persons' freedoms and rights, and therefore that would be reportable to the ICO. And if we go on to the next slide there, when do you have to report to a data subject? And the threshold is higher for data subjects, and that we need to be clear on that just because you're reporting to the ICO doesn't mean you're reporting to the data subject. You need to identify a high risk to their rights or freedoms. Unlike the ICO, there's no hard deadline for reporting to data subjects, but you're expected to do it as soon as reasonably possible. And that's a sensitive communication to draw. So, you know, I would advise caution when doing that, and making sure that is checked for, as you would the regulator, that's checked for accuracy, but also checked for clarity. Because remember, we're not communicating with the regulator who understands the rules up and down. We're communicating with with the average Joe. So just be very cautious and be cognizant of that fact. Then if we go on to the next slide, just again, give you a rough example of what would be considered a high risk. A large leak of customer personal data, including account information, is copied from your environment by a malicious actor. And that gets pushed into a high risk because we've now left the environment. There's sensitive data. Well, it's not special category data, but it's certainly high risk customer data in relation to payment fraud and somebody forming a profile on that customer. So that relates to that suggests a higher risk. If we go on to the next slide there, how does this reporting differ from the FCA? Very simply, there's no separate reporting templates, and there's no word limit either on these ones. So you fill out a Word document and you chat about what's happened and how that's impacted people. Now, you may submit further communications to the regulator through that same form. So you can update that data, but it is you're not submitting separate reports. There's no separate templates. It's all through the same template. And on to the next slide there, and how you're reporting this to the data subject. You're really telling them everything that you've told the regulator, that being the nature of the breach, the likely impact, any proposed measures, and any contact details. You're reporting all of that minus the nature of the breach to the data subject, and you're telling them in a more simplified version what happened and what they should do to protect themselves. And if we go on to the next slide there, so just some tips and considerations. When testing business continuity, consider personal data breaches and how you would communicate. So for instance, if it's impossible to get to communicate with the data subjects directly, the affected data subjects directly, then you may wish to put out a public notice. Where does that public notice go? Does it go on your social media? Does it become a header on your web page? Things like that. And regardless of whether the incident is considered reportable or not, as with major incidents, you are putting that within your breach register. And then we're on to the final slide. Just future considerations on the final slide. And that is, as we all know, things are a wee bit up in the air due to Brexit, especially with GDPR. So just from that perspective, from this perspective, it may change who you report to going forward. So if you have, for instance, a European branch and you service European clientele, then in all likelihood you'll have a different main establishment and therefore a main regulator, and you may need to communicate issues to them rather than what is likely the case at the moment, and that is your domestic regulator, although not always the case, but it is something to bear in mind going forward. And honestly, we could talk about that forever, but we'll cut off there. That's my final slide there. And yeah, happy enough to start taking questions now. I think Simon will rejoin as well.
Hello there.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Simon, for that run through of how to handle a payment and data incident. Look, I'm sure you've all found that of interest and have taken away some key points to implement in your own businesses. But look, we have a few questions here now. I know, Simon, you have to jump off, so do so when you have to, and we'll hopefully have Greg on for the last few questions. So I'll start off with you, Simon. First question, what's the biggest mistake people make when dealing with an incident?
There's quite a few biggest mistakes that people make, but I think the most important thing is trying to get things back up and running before fixing a problem. So instead of spending the time that I talked about, you know, in doing the reconnaissance, the assessment, the remediation tasks, instead of doing that, they instantly try to get everything back up and running without assessing what's been happening before. And that can be really difficult, because you think that you're back up and running and suddenly the worst happens again, and in a worse way in many cases. And that's really, really difficult sometimes to then recover from. If you've just posted a message out on Twitter or to your clients saying, yes, we had a bit of an issue, but we're back up and running again now, and then suddenly someone takes over your Twitter feed or your communicates with your employees directly or your clients directly, then that makes it look even worse and will have a worse impact. One of the things that is, I think, really important to get right is that assessment phase, and also the documentation phase. Greg spoke so brilliantly there about some of the work that he suggests that you do, which is all around making sure that you have to do these interim reports, make sure that you've got these reports in place. It's really important to get that right. It will help you as well, because you will understand more about what you're meant to be reporting if you're constantly documenting what you're doing. So yeah, I think that rush into doing getting things back to normal is sometimes really difficult.
Okay, Simon, thank you for that. Greg, moving on to yourself then. Let me see. Now, this is some other questions. Now, maybe this was for Simon, but does a standard like ISO 27001 mean you're less likely to experience a data or payments incident?
Well, yes and no. If you're following it correctly, then you will have the security there to protect you against the majority of data incidents. That does not mean that it's foolproof. And in fact, the ISO 27001 will require you to have some sort of processes to react to a data incident. So, I mean, sitting here and pretending that because we have security in place, that doesn't mean we need any kind of remediation processes in place isn't going to help anyone. And in fact, it's going to be detrimental for when that proves to be incorrect. I mean, we can have the best security in the world. If we get hit by somebody advanced enough, then it's simply not going to solve any issues. So, yes and no. Obviously, ISO 27001 is preferred, and it is a good framework to follow. But it isn't the silver bullet. It doesn't correct everything you want it to correct.
It's like everything is. It's only as good as people actually doing what they say they're doing. Yeah. Okay. So next question then, Greg. How does the FCA usually deal with a major incident?
So when you report to the FCA, honestly, and I hate using this phrase, but the reality is that it's very case by case based. So I wouldn't say that you need to expect an aggressive front from the FCA. I would say that is unlikely. So the FCA aren't going to turn around and say, this is horrendous, what happened? We're going to need interviews with everyone. We're going to need to discuss this. The FCA are very cognizant of the fact that incidents do happen, and that is a reality. And it's about how we react to those incidents that, mm-hmm. that the FCA is as interested about rather than what necessarily happened. So what is the FCA's interest in your particular case going to be? It's very case by case. They're going to base it on a couple of things. What is their risk assessment of your firm itself? So how intertwined are you with the economy as a whole? When you're affected, do other payment service providers get affected? How many transactions have been affected in the wider market? Things like that. They're gonna see what your risk is on that side, and then they're gonna evaluate the incident on its own merit. So if it was a fact of you've gone down for the day, there's been you've activated your crisis mode and things like that, then you're less likely to hear back many questions from the FCA than you would if you've had a massive hit to your regulatory capital, because as right now the FCA are focusing on prudential issues, so that would invoke a bit more of a response from the FCA and a bit more conversation. But I wouldn't expect aggression, I suppose, is the point there.
Okay. Lastly, Greg, because I think this is we don't have much time left. What are industry's best practices for helping prevent a major incident? And then the second part of that, what are the common pitfalls and how to avoid them? So just a quick, if you can, response to that. So what are industry's best practices for helping prevent a major incident?
So preventing major incidents is really coming down to what's your protection framework? What's your training? So something like, as you previously mentioned there, ISO 27001 would be something that you would implement that would require you to have effective prevention methods. The reality of a prevention method is it's not 100%. No matter how much prevention you put in place, the reality will occur that you will suffer data incidents. And whether that comes on the side of something that you've designed incorrectly is less likely than it comes from your own member of staff clicking on a phishing email, even if you have ran out the training months before. It's people aren't perfect, so you will eventually suffer something at some point. And then what was it, best practice on how to respond? Elaine, was that the second part of that?
Yes, the question was, what are the industry best practices for helping prevent a major incident? And then the second part of it was, what are the common pitfalls and how to avoid them? So as you mentioned there, likely people, isn't it? It's human error and
yeah, and I think Simon touched on this in his first question of what are the errors, and I'm talking effectively about you just try and get back online and there's us, we're back up and running, this operational event has ended, and the reality is that it's a little bit deeper than you realized, especially if you've been brought down through a cyber incident and somebody's installed a backdoor into the system. You set yourself back up and running again, and they get back in again, and you're back to step one. So I think that it would be a common pitfall and something to avoid. Make sure you assess the issue before you just blindly get everything back up and running.
Okay, Greg, thank you so much. Look, I think that's all we have time for. If anyone has any further questions that we didn't get to, please note we will put them to Simon and Greg, and they have promised to come back to you. Similarly, if you would like any help and help it, in securing your systems and putting plans in place or training, look, don't hesitate to give us a call. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Simon. And thank you, everyone else, for your attention this afternoon. And enjoy the rest of your day. All the very best.
Thanks, everyone.